Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullist, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Asian Man Records has released over 300 albums. Of course, people know the big names like Less Than Jake, Alkaline Trio, AJJ, Bomb the Music Industry, and Slapstick. But there have been several lesser-known records on the label that deserve just as much attention. Today we're going to focus on Short Round, a brilliant pop-punk slash indie slash emo group from Milpitas, California. The leader of the group, Jason Tin, was a huge ska fan and joined Mike Park's group The Chinkies in the late 90s when he was just 17 years old. A few years later, in 2002, Mike released Short Round's debut record, Language. It was a nice addition to the emo punk sound popular on the label at the time. However, there is a few ska songs on the record as well. We wanted to ask Jason about his experience playing in The Chinkies, as well as Short Round, and a later project called Marathon States.
I don't really remember when I became friends with Jason, but I've been friends with Jason for a really long time.
Yeah, I'm not as close to him as you, but yeah, I know him too. And I remember just like seeing him at one of the Asian Man reunions and, you know, just being like, we were like old friends when we stopped and talked and stuff. But I don't really quite remember when I met him and when I became friends with him either.
Jason was just like such a fast, immediate friend of mine, just goofing around and like rapping and like doing the robot with each other mm-hmm. and just being stupid. I really miss hanging out with Jason. He lives in Japan now.
Oh, so it's going to be even harder to hang out with him.
Yeah, going to have to go to Japan to hang out with Jason.
So we need to get Omnigon Eve 6 tour to Japan.
In Defense of Ska presents the Japan tour, reconnecting with Jason Tin.
Let's get right into a serious conversation.
Yeah.
Adam told me that you guys used to play this game where you would slap each other's faces. And...
yes.
Give us the details.
What was the... I don't know the impetus of that game, Adam.
At first, we were like, we would just pretend that we were going to slap each other in the face, I think. And then we actually just started slapping each other in the face.
So,
and then I think we stopped because you actually did it really hard one time. And I got worried that you were actually mad at me.
No. I do remember slap. I think I was like, okay, I'm going to slap you. And then the look on your face was just like no words and no ow. It's just like, what happened?
Because you had to reach so high to slap me too.
Yes, for people who don't know. There are a lot of differences between Adam and I, height being one of them.
Yeah, I don't know how we started doing that, but that was definitely a thing that used to happen a lot.
Was this like a tour game where you guys would go to each other's houses and do this?
Just whenever we would see each other, like at somebody else's show, playing a show together, hanging out.
I didn't mean for that game to stop.
Well, you moved to Japan. That's the only reason it stopped.
When do you think the last time was that you guys slapped each other?
Well, the last... probably that time. Because the last time I saw you, Adam, was in, we were in Oakland.
Yeah.
And we walked by the cereal place. We went to, what, 1234?
To 1234 Go Records?
Yeah, yeah. We went there. You gave me some warm beer.
Why did I have warm beer?
It was like leftover from a show.
Okay, that makes sense.
And you're like, here you go. I'm like, okay.
And nobody slapped anybody?
No slapping.
Wow. No slapping. Slappers off.
It's kind of sad getting old.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You played in a band. You played in a band called the Chinkies.
I played in a band that today would might be. Oh well, okay, they're still around. But yeah, I played in the Chinkies from 1999.
And you toured quite a bit with them. Mm-hmm. What was it like touring with Mike Park?
I mean, you know, I think everyone is familiar with Mike being who he is. You know, food is important. Free food especially is important. Just doing crazy stuff. I think the most important thing for me, at least, was since coming from Rycom, I didn't have a lot of previous musical experience, and I lived in an area where there was not a lot of, you know, opportunity to go see shows. Like, I know you guys were talking about like Gilroy, and me growing up in the South Bay, it was literally difficult. So not only starting a band with him, but it was just basically a crash course into the ska punk scene. It was very overwhelming, but he was, you know, you couldn't find a better guide, honestly. And but yeah, it was really fun. A lot of crazy stories. I don't know. I would have to be more specific. I'm sorry.
Do you remember Mike getting crazy on tour?
I mean, I remember him being naked a lot.
Yeah, okay. Can we isolate a specific nudity experience?
No.
It's just a blur.
It's just a big, muscly calved blur to me. skanking in his underwear. Skanking in his underwear. Like, if I had to give the Cliff Notes version of Mike Park on tour, it's the underwear, free food.
Free food. Skanking in his underwear and not liking to drive.
well, thankfully, we were never in a position where that had to happen, because we always had, like, we actually had drivers, usually. I think except for Mexico. When we played in Mexico with Voodoo and Bucko Nye, one of the adults drove. I was only 17 at the time. I was straight out of high school.
Where exactly were you from? That didn't have like much access to shows before this.
Yeah, you said South Bay, but where exactly in the South Bay?
Milpitas.
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 Yeah, M-town.
Tell the listeners about Milpitas if they've never been.
Milpitas has been once described as the place people drive through to get to somewhere else, next to San Jose, Fremont, and some little suburb. Predominantly, you know, Asian gangsters and big Asian community, but that was pretty much it. We didn't really have any shows until it was like 96 when one of my classmates, he put on a show, and it was Slow Gherkin. And that was one show that still resonates in my mind. And then like 1 year, it was Slow Gherkin. It was basically a Raj Records showcase, kind of. So it was like Slow Gherkin, Blind Spot, Punch the Clown. And other than that, if you didn't put on shows yourself, you had to go somewhere else. Either San Jose or take the BART to San Francisco or Oakland or whatever.
Where was that show at? Because I remember seeing Gherkin in Milpitas around that time. I wonder if I was at that show.
You definitely probably were, because that was at the community center. It was basically located next to a big strip mall.
Pretty certain I was there, yeah.
I think Ibopa played one of the years, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, speaking of Ibopa, didn't Jamie record the first Short Round demo?
Yes. Yes.
Tell us about that.
I heard he was recording local bands through Christian from Firme. And I was like, okay. And then I would always see Jamie at shows, and then we talked, and he was super, super, super nice. We recorded at his house the very, very first Short Round EP. And it was interesting because super kind, hospitable guy. But then I remember sometimes he would, unrelated, go into like little fits of anger.
Directed towards the recording process or what?
No, like it would be like a phone call from like somebody else, like a relative or like his mom or something or whatever. And he would just, I don't remember if he threw the phone or if he shot the phone or something.
Shot
like with a BB gun or something. But yeah, he got, it was weird to see him like be so distinctively calm 1 minute and then compartmentalize his emotions and then get angry another. But recording with him, he was really kind and everything. And then I think I read in an interview with him after, I don't know if it was about us, but he was like, yeah, making money recording for some really bad ska bands.
I sort of remember that. I remember him saying, oh yeah, I used to make ends meet by recording these like terrible pop punk or ska bands.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember wondering, is he talking about Jason? I remember thinking
most that. Likely. I mean, I couldn't sing.
How did you end up being in Chinkies? So you were 17 when you joined that band?
I was a fresh young 17. We could that's it. We could thank Slow Gherkin for that. Because I just always went to their shows. And so about the time they got signed to Asian Man, I think that could be around the time when Mike started looking for members. And then with Slow Gherkin and their posse, so their friends, whatever, they would talk to me about that. Like, I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And then I talked with Mike at a show, very like no longer than like a minute. And he's like, can you play? I'm like, yeah. He's like, how's your tone? I'm like, good. Obviously it wasn't, but yeah, I mean, we talked on the phone, and then I met up with him in person to do the video, music video. And then everything kept on rolling from there. So it was not a strict vetting process. but he trusted me.
The music video was the first thing you did?
That was the first thing we did. It was a video for You Don't Know that was never released. So if you look on the back of the Chinkies album, well, there's two different versions. So I don't know what's on the back of the red version. The first Chinkies Are Coming, on the back of that, there's a photo of all of us, and that's from the video.
What was the premise of the video? What was the what did it look like?
Playing in a kitchen. I don't know whose kitchen it was. And the thing is, it wasn't all the real members, quote-unquote. So you had Todd Inoue from the Metro, San Jose Metro.
Oh, Todd was in
it? Todd was in it, yeah. And then you had Greg, who usually plays guitar, but he was playing drums in the video. And Mia was Mia, playing bass. But then it was just the premise of us playing in the kitchen, and then also a tiny little cramped practice space, which is where you see the picture. And then I think they tried to do some like karaoke kind of scenes, but that never made it in the video, I think.
So it wasn't released, but was it actually edited together so you guys could watch it?
Yeah, we watched it, and
So. Are you sure it's not released? I swear I've seen the footage from the practice space.
I just remember the reaction of it not being so good. So in my memory, it was never released.
Who do you know who shot it? Was it like just a buddy or was it like somebody who actually made videos?
It was one of his friends. You, Aaron, you might know him.
Okay.
I don't remember his name, but he was around that time. I think you were probably still living with him, with Mike.
I know I was living. I was living with Mike when Chinkies was starting to come together because I remember you guys were using the practice space. And I think that might have even been why he built it.
That might be.
Can you guys just explain to people who are listening what the practice space at Mike's house looked like?
So, it was in the garage. So it was just like this little teeny, God, it was so small. Like if you had like a 4-piece rock band, you guys were all cramped in there, like elbow to elbow playing. And I don't remember if it was soundproofed or if it was just wood.
I feel like it had carpet on the walls. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely carpet.
Okay, it had carpet. So, because my band, I was in a band at the time called the Sudsmen. And like we used that practice space too. So I did get to play in that practice space. And then I think at the very same time, Chinkies were rehearsing as well.
Right. You're talking about the practice space in the Los Gatos house. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So the video was recorded at a different place.
Oh, was it?
Different. Yeah. It was a different. I don't know whose house it was. I don't know why I want to say Chuck, but. Anyways, so it was recorded in a different place, and the guy who recorded it, I remember him getting sued because he was part of the camera crew, the video crew that helped record Aaliyah's last video.
And so why did he get sued? Just for being part of it?
I don't know. Obviously, Mike has a better memory than I do, so.
Since the first album was already recorded, with Slapstick, then I assume the next thing is that you were just playing shows, like, right? Shows was next before recording? Okay. Was the Japan tour, was that the first thing that you guys did?
That was not the first thing. The first thing was in 1999, we played in Mofitas. Yeah, we played in January 99. I just graduated and I put on a show. It was supposed to be just my band and some other bands. Then Mike said, hey, you know, let's get some practice in. And so we played on the show unannounced. And it was just a bunch of, you know, random bands. And then we played first. And it was great because my guitar string broke immediately the first song. And then I think the next week, it was maybe the next week or the week after, soon after, we played in Mexico with Voodoo Glow Skulls and Bucko Nine.
So
and how are those shows?
Yeah.
It was amazing. Like, we drove there and it was just really nice. We played in Tijuana and Ensenada. And Tijuana was huge. I don't know, maybe 1,000 people, like just a ton of bands. It was scary that we were told not to bring most of our instruments because there might be theft. And I remember the security there had machine guns. And then we played in Ensenada. It was really fun. I didn't drink back then. So it was I had a very different experience. But it was really cool, like especially meeting the guys from Voodoo Glow Skulls, because I loved them. So it was really weird for like a fan to be able to play with one of their favorite bands at the time, and they were all really, really nice.
So, how many shows with any band had you played before going to Mexico?
So, before that was the Chinkies, and then maybe I would say I played maybe 5 or so with my own band before that, but before then. Not like punk shows, like I was part of this music school in my town and we would do things like play like county fairs, like the Santa Clara County Fair or the Gilroy Festival. So we did a lot of that. But in terms of like actual shows, not much experience.
Okay. So, this thing that you did what exactly was it? Let's go back a little bit.
So it was a musical, like, you know, anybody could join it. or whatever. And then for people who wanted to learn how to be performers, you know, you could join a band and we do covers. We'd pick our own covers. And for me, it was me and my friends who introduced me to ska. So we try to not play popular songs because we are angsty. And so we would play, I know we played Anxiety Tech by Skink and Pickle.
Okay.
We tried to do Toasters, but the guitarist who chose a song, he chose a song about suicide, so we couldn't do that. And we did a Tom Jones cover of It's Not Unusual, but ska. So we did that kind of stuff. We play at county fairs and people didn't know what the hell was going on, but they're like, oh, live music and people not playing super, super popular music. So it was a fun experience.
How much skanking was happening in the audience?
I would actually force my friends who would show up, I would force them to skank. Honestly. One time we played at Santa Clara County Fair, and we played Impression That I Get. For some reason, because obviously I sound like Dickie Barrett, so of course that's a good match. One of my friends was there, and he was like a total skinhead kind of guy. And I'm like, you're the only one, in the microphone, I'm like, you're the only one who knows how to skank, so can you please do it? And I just put him on the spot. So, yeah, skanking was mandatory.
And did he do it?
Yeah, yeah. Everyone was looking at him.
He had to.
Yeah, peer pressure.
Peer pressure, so good.
We'll be right back after this.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
So you played the Gilroy Garlic Festival also?
A long time ago. I don't remember much about it, but yeah.
All right. Yeah, I didn't know you came to Gilroy.
Yeah. I didn't. Sorry, I didn't tell you. I'm sorry.
You were like three blocks from my childhood house.
Yeah. What's going on?
We've always been meant to be together.
Did you try the garlic ice cream when you were at the festival?
No.
What? Why?
Well, so you have to. That's why.
I'm feeling like I lost out on a great experience. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it'll still be there the next time you make it to the garlic festival.
Okay.
So, did Japan though? That came pretty quick after the Mexico tour.
It did, but I wasn't on it.
Oh, wow.
I got grounded for like half a year. So,
what did you get grounded for?
I got grounded because, see, I had already, I might be getting my timeline switched, but basically I graduated early because I got sent to a continuation school, which is for all the dropouts and the gang members. But
right.
I got sent there even though I didn't have to go. I was always cutting class, so I got grounded a lot. And then, but because of that, Mike thought I couldn't go. Mike believed that my parents wouldn't say yes. So they didn't take me. And then I asked my mom, I was like, Mom, I know you're mad at me, but my band is going to Japan, but it's too late. If I asked you, could I go to Japan, would you say yes? She said yes. So, but it's okay.
So, I mean, is that why you moved to Japan as an adult? Is it because of this?
Yeah, that was a huge, going to Japan the next year in 2000, in year 2000, I went with them to Japan, and it was just, the floodgates burst open. And yeah, it was like a dream. And then I moved a few years ago. Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah. But I think after the first Japan tour, I think after that, I don't know when it was, but then we did the Asian Man Showcase tour in California.
Who was on that?
At first, I thought Link 80 was supposed to be on that, but for some reason, you guys weren't.
What year was it?
Okay, now I know why. Okay, never mind. It was 99, the year of the rat.
Okay.
What is the year of the rat? I don't know. 1999, in March, it was Slowgurkin. No, was it? Slowgurkin, I think, maybe played. Alkaline Trio played their first, it was like, I think it was Alkaline's first time in the Bay Area. And then it was MU330. Yeah, MU, Chinkies, Alkaline Trio. Pretty sure it's Slowgurkin. I don't remember who else. I think there's like maybe one more band.
Nice. And how was that?
It was amazing. Because I remember I was the first one to show up at the Gilman show. That was our first show. And then Alkaline Trio is the second band to show up. So it was just Alkaline Trio and me, and I was a huge Alkaline fan. And then I asked them, hey, I heard that we're supposed to borrow your gear. And Matt Skiba is like, yeah, we don't allow Asians to, he didn't say Asians, but we don't allow Asians to buy all our stuff. So
damn.
So then we didn't play. No, yeah, it was great. it was great, and then that was basically kind of set off my love for MU. I already had been a fan of them, but that was my first time seeing them live, and it was just everything, because that was during their self-titled time. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, but it was still for me as a longtime fan. It still felt really weird that, like, it felt like, oh my god, am I dying soon and no one has told me, because I get to have these dreams fulfilled playing with bands I love. And my first time playing at Gilman, we played Gilman, Petaluma, Santa Cruz, and Southern California. And that was really fun.
I hear Adam has talked about before that on a tour that you guys were all on, that Chinkies had to wear suits.
Oh, this wasn't that wasn't a tour though that Jason was on.
Oh man, another one. Okay, well never mind.
But anyways, but that was on all of our tours. Everyone wore suits except for Mia, and I didn't wear a suit ever. I wore like a V-neck. Either way, yeah, we had to wear suits all the time to keep up an image of, you know, I think at that time Mike was really into the Noise Conspiracy.
Okay.
International Noise Conspiracy. So he, and also, you know, there's the whole Toot Toot thing, but I think having that kind of look kind of set us apart a little bit. Other side, other than, you know, completely Asian band, but, you know.
One or the other.
One or the other. Pick one. Both.
would the suits get nasty show after show?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what was that like?
Every time. They, you know, everyone smelled. But we just got used to it. It felt like, you know, we were, at least for me, it felt like I was paying my dues being around smelly stuff.
Yeah.
But we would always change after our set. And that's where, you know, Mike in underwear comes in. So,
yeah. But like, I know the feeling though of putting on your show clothes like the next day.
Yeah.
And like, maybe you didn't get a good chance to like really air them out. Like, that's the worst feeling.
Yeah. But you're in a band and people don't care. I don't know.
Yeah. True.
I don't know.
Once you put on the nasty clothes and then start sweating in them again, it's like, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah. It was grody, but. It was sweat well earned, I think, maybe.
So Adam and Jason, had you guys ever been on the same tour at the same time then?
Yes.
The only tour I think we did together was Plea for Peace.
Yeah, we didn't play. Well, you played.
I played, but we also were both crew.
We were both crew. I played maybe like a handful of solo shows, or solo sets. Yeah, you were stage manager, I was merch.
Oh.
Yep.
Yeah.
I have a really good picture of you doing merch at Emo's in Austin.
The Emo's show is a good one. Because I'm thinking,
what do you remember about the Emo's show?
You know exactly what I'm thinking about.
No, I don't.
Yeah, you do. You were playing, Link 80 was playing, and I was all the way in the back of the room. And you decided,
oh, yeah,
with your big lumbering body to jump onto the crowd. and then we both like pointed at each other.
Yep.
Even though you're now like a, kind of like a turtle on your back, but you're still, we still made contact. It was beautiful.
I mean, I don't get a lot of opportunities to crowd surf.
It was amazing.
Emo's was definitely one of those places that I felt okay doing that at for some reason, because they had those rafters.
Yeah.
And so you could crowd surf and you could grab onto the rafters and kind of like half be on the audience, half be holding yourself up in the rafters.
If you're really tall, yes.
Yeah. But oh man, I fully remember that, just being up there doing the last couple lines of the song Packing Up.
Yeah.
And pointing at you and you pointing back from the back of the room. That's a great moment.
Yeah, on that tour, I think that was one of my favorite moments of Link 80. Link 80 set was the part where you just break it down. And everything got really heavy and the audience went really muddy. That was really good. Yeah.
I remember it was getting crazier and crazier through that tour. Like, we played at the Galaxy Club in Dallas and I dove off the monitors, like, and I did like a handspring off the monitor.
Uh-huh.
And like, I just remember like the audience kind of like caught me and then lifted me high above the stage and then slammed me down into the stage. Like I came back down onto the stage from above the stage. And then we played at the Nile.
Uh-huh.
And we did it and there was a barricade there. And I handed my guitar off to Steve Borth,
uh-huh,
grabbed the microphone and ran from the back of the stage to dive into the audience. And so I had to clear like a 5-foot gap. So I took like a running start and everybody moved out of the way.
No.
And I went straight to the floor and probably bruised a rib, jumped up and finished the song. But I just remember talking to Dan Pothest about it later and him just going, "Oh, Adam's dead. Adam's dead." When he saw me hit, he thought for sure I just broke my neck.
The Dallas show, I have difficulty remembering because that's when, you know, it was all your friends who came to the show.
Right.
Elizabeth and all them.
Oh, Kirsten and Elizabeth.
Yeah, and like I just remember getting a bit. I had a few drinks, and I spent about maybe half of the time breakdancing. I'm sure shirts were sold and CDs were sold. Breakdancing was a priority.
Did you do the pop locking move where you put the apple in your mouth and take it down to your stomach and back up?
No, it was just like a baby at a wedding, just like trying to.
Were you a good merch person?
I don't know. I thought like every day I was going to get fired by Mike.
Okay.
Yeah, did he ever have a talking to with you?
I think the only time was like the second plea for peace. He told me, hey, don't drink so much. But other than that, he's just like, remember to do this. And I would always forget because that's just how I am.
Right.
But not a super talking to. But the thing is, our relationship was a lot like big brother, little brother. So the communication sometimes was a little different. Never a stern talking to, honestly.
Okay.
But yeah, I remember honestly thinking, oh, I was going to get fired. And then I got on the phone with the person he was seeing at the time, and she was like, oh, he tells me you've been doing great. I'm like, really? Because I haven't heard that. So.
What do you remember about the show in Atlanta?
Okay, there's two things. I remember Mike doing a somersault and then hurting himself.
Okay.
And then the one thing I think that you're talking about is the woman who was like 7 foot tall. Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
It was kind of like a forced perspective kind of thing, because I took pictures.
Yeah.
And I remember before that, like, everyone was like, Jason, because I'm 5'4", and she was like 7 feet tall. Everyone's like, you got to take a picture with her. I'm like, okay. And then you take a picture, and it just looks like she's really far away, but she's not. She's really close. What is it? Like, it looks like I'm really far away, but I'm actually, like, right in front of the camera.
Yeah, so I remember seeing her walk into the room and feeling like, the whole room like tilted because she was like normal, like she was like very normal proportions. She wasn't like long and skinny. She was like a normal looking person, just huge. She was super tall. She played on like the volleyball team.
Right.
And I remember after the show, just coming outside to like load out and you're just talking to her, just looking straight up, just the hugest smile on your face.
yes.
Adam doesn't normally get to experience what it's like to meet a tall person.
Right, that's why he talks to me. So the opposite phenomenon, which is funny because like in Atlanta they have the sci-fi whatever convention, Dragon Con, and I went there 1 year, and anytime I saw a tall woman, there are a lot of like super, 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 super tall women there. Anytime I saw them, I would get a picture with them, and it would always be me tilting my head back, trying to talk to them.
So wait, you this is like a thing you do?
It was.
Well, he has to do it. He's 5'4".
Yeah.
He has to tilt his head all the way back.
No, I mean the part where you get a photo.
Oh, the taking the picture?
Yeah. Yeah, for a while, it was women holding me like a baby. And then after a while... No one ever argued like, hey, would you hold me like a baby? They're like, oh, sure. Yeah, it happened a lot.
I remember that happening a lot.
How would you just say it? That's how you would present
just
this?
Like that. Yeah.
Yeah, just like that.
To a complete stranger.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I got 5 minutes. They'd be
like, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Let me put my coffee down. Yeah.
Let me pick this baby up.
And then, okay, so once the photo's taken, what do you say? Just thank you? And then you leave?
Yeah. It's like, yeah. Well, okay. See ya. I think during that era, I didn't make the most clearest of decisions, so my memory's a little fuzzy.
All right.
Sorry.
I mean, one of my favorite things about the tall girl is that she came the next time we played at at the masquerade. Uh-huh. And she brought her boyfriend, and he was 6'2".
Aww.
He was like this giant, like yoked 6'2" dude, but he looked tiny next to her. Like he's big, huge, broad shoulders, tiny. Love it.
We talked about your band briefly, Short Round.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell the youngins where this name came from.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, so according to a comment on Punk News, I was the actor Indiana Jones who played Short Round. So I have the right to call my band that. But in reality, racist guy. That was it did come from that movie, but I was just like, okay, whatever. And then I played in a band before that locally, and then I started a new band, which I was like, it's going to be called Short Round. It's going to be do this. I actually had goals. And then we played our first show again in Milpitas with Slow Gherkin. And then we went through a bunch of lineup changes. And this is around the same time, you know, we were touring with the Chinkies were touring. And then we started playing with the Lawrence Arms whenever they were in town. And then one day Mike comes over to my house and he plays me the new Chinkies record. And then he's like, oh, can you play the Short Round demo? I'm like, okay. And I played it for him. He's like, all right, so this is what we're going to do. You're going to record with Steve Choi. You're going to record an album that's going to be on Asian Man, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, uh-huh. I didn't see that coming because I never expected for Short Round to be on Asian Moon, because there was a lot of kind of, what do you call it, imposter syndrome. But then we ended up being on Asian Man. Choi, we did not end up recording with Choi, but Brendan ended up being our producer, so we recorded in Chicago, and that was really fun recording with Brendan to see that different side of him.
Yeah, what was he like in that setting?
He was actually really, really just serious. He was a good mentor. Working with Matt Allison was really fun. After every session, none of us were old enough to drink, but they would always sneak us into the L&L in Chicago. And I distinctly remember one time there was one night where there was a strict door guy. So Brendan's wife dropped a glass to get the door guy's attention, and then we just snuck it.
That's a good trick.
That's an amazing trick. Yeah. But, the experience was really positive. He taught me a lot, and Matt was just amazing. I didn't see him after that until right before I moved to Japan a couple of years ago. I went to Chicago as a last hurrah to see the Lawrence Arms, and he was at the bar. So, but yeah, it was a great experience.
The record, though, that record came out in like 2002, right?
2002. We recorded in 2001, October or November.
Okay. So you were part of the AMR Scotta Emo pipeline then?
I was, yes. Yeah, when I went through a lot of different, because I initially started, you know, listening to Nirvana and all that 90s stuff, like Sonic Youth, and then Bikini Kill, and then there was the Skink and Pickle side, the Dill Records side. So I didn't really have allegiance to like one or another, but I initially did not like all that emo stuff because of the people who did a complete 180. You know, I didn't start dressing ska or dressing emo, or not really. Well, I guess I did. I don't know. But yeah, I listened to that Impossibles record, and that kind of set off a spark.
Yeah,
that Impossibles record and that Animal Chin stuff was kind of a big deal.
That was big in terms of like the direction you went with.
Yeah, because I knew I couldn't play like two Tony kind of stuff. I just did not have the groove to really do ska on my own. So like with the Chinkies, I could get my Ska feelings out. And then with Short Round, that was more of like the pop punk. Emo kind of pop punk. Pop punk emo kind of stuff. Melodic pop punk kind of stuff. Because I was... That was really my kind of jam.
We'll be right back after this.
Let's talk about this song called Cleansing Cut Scrape.
Mm.
So we did squeeze a ska song on the record.
We did. Well, there's two. I think there's two. But yeah, there's that.
It was kind of less and less and less of ska at that point. It's particularly like the style you were playing. But you had a ska song or two. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my favorite. I think that's maybe my favorite song of the record. And strangely enough, I wrote that on Plea for Peace. Because Mike...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Mike was like, you've... Because I was supposed to record soon after I got back from Plea for Peace, and Mike was like, you gotta write a song as much as you can. And so I would use his guitar every day. And then I wrote a big chunk of that song while we were on tour. There's no specific motive behind it, but it was that kind of ska that I get, like the downbeat kind of stuff. Minor chord kind of stuff.
Yeah.
When I listen to like a special song, those are my kind of favorite songs.
That's a great song. What can you tell us about the song in terms of like, you know, lyrically and stuff, and what was kind of inspiring it as you were writing it on Plea for Peace?
It was exactly where I was in my mindset. It was exactly where I was in terms of mindset, like kind of directionless, lot of anxiety. Because outside of like playing shows, I was still a very, very awkward kid. I was just insane. So it was a lot of just getting all my frustrations, mainly my anxieties, my social anxieties out, being an introvert. So having a ska song like that, but it had to be downbeat and a minor chord because... I don't know. Those aren't feelings to dance to. So,
or you can dance and just stare at your shoes.
Yeah. When you were touring or playing shows or doing merch, I mean, were those feelings prominent, or is this a situation where they were less than?
I think it was really difficult playing in bands and touring because, first and foremost, I was, you know, just some ska punk fan from the suburbs who didn't have like what you would call that kind of punk upbringing or cred. So I had a lot of imposter syndrome, and I never felt like completely integrated. So like when we would play shows, everyone was always older than me, except for Choi. But Steve Choi is Steve Choi, you know. You know, he has his whole history of being a musician. And then it always just felt really awkward, honestly. Going on the Plea for Peace tour was super fun, but at the same time, it was just, I was just like screaming, internal screaming, because I had no idea how to talk to any of these people, except for like Adam was always cool. Adam was always cool. Ted Mole from MU330 was great because he was a nerd. I think he still is, probably, but
yeah, he's a scientist, but, so
yeah.
So he's nerd.
I love that guy, but for the most part, it was like a completely different thing that took a long time for me to try to relate with everything, because I was like, this is a community that I'm not used to, you know. At my school, my high school, it was just, it was mostly hip hop or R&B is what people listened to. And so getting into like the punk scene in those years, when there were a lot of my seniors, you know, like the Asian Man bands and everything, it was really just, it was awkward, super, super awkward. It's like, cause like, the people I hung out with, none of them were, not really any of them were musicians. They were just all 9-to-5ers. And they were not really creative types. So it was a completely different world for me.
Yeah. I imagine too, doing the merch was like, that's like a, you need to be like chatty, you know, people are, you're constantly dealing with people. You're constantly talking with people. Maybe you're even like trying to sell them a little bit on stuff.
Yeah. That's the fun thing about having a writer and beer. I'm looking back on it, I'm really embarrassed, but I just partied kind of, but inside there was just a lot of like, not a lot of, I don't know. I just drank quite a bit on the tour. So
that's kind of how you coped with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a little nutty.
What do you remember about on the Plea for Peace tour, hanging out in the back lounge?
I didn't have a lot of time hanging out in the back lounge, did I?
Really? I felt like that's where you would, did you actually have a bunk on the bus or did you sleep back there?
Oh, you're talking about the bus. Okay. I think sometimes I had to sleep in the back. I think I did.
Because if I remember it right, I slept on the front bench in the bus, and you slept in the back lounge,
right?
And people would just hang out back there until like 3 in the morning.
The Tetris lounge,
and you would not get to sleep.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm alive now. After making Chris Murray mad during our Tetris games,
how did you make him mad?
Just we would play Tetris against each other. And then, Adam, do you remember that?
Barely.
So, it was like a new Tetris.
But I want to hear about Chris Murray getting mad though.
Because we always would play Tetris in the back, and then there was this one function you could do, like you save up blocks in your column, and then when the timing's right, you could dump those blocks into another player's column, and I think basically that he would get mad at me about that, if I remember correctly.
Oh, because you had a lot of blocks and you threw them at him?
Yes. But he was a fantastic musician and he was a great part of the Plea for Peace tour.
But I love the idea of Chris Murray being like so super chill on that tour, playing acoustic guitar songs, but then getting mad at you about Tetris.
Oh, totally. Tetris unchilled him, yes.
So you, there's a big gap of time. We're not like, you're not doing Short Round and you're not playing music, but then you come back and do Marathon States, which I love. I love that record.
Oh, thank you.
It's you, Max and Morgan from Hard Girls, right?
Yes.
Who else is involved with that project?
Very, very interesting. So I moved to Georgia and then every time I would visit California, I would set up around like a couple of days with Max and Morgan. And we'd just write some songs. Bob Vielma from Shinobu would record like the drums and the bass. And then I would take the tracks back to Georgia where we would record, I would record the guitar and vocals with Joel Hatstat. Joel Hatstat played in a band with Jeff Rosenstock and called Pegasus's XL. And also Joel Hatstat would eventually start doing like, I guess, mastering for a bunch of Asian Man records. I think he did some of the most recent Mike Park records. And then I had my friend Sam Paulson. She played in Man or Astro Man and she did some vocals on it. So she was my kind of ska friend in Athens.
Was there a reason why you kind of didn't play music for a while before this?
Yeah. I left California for a lot of reasons. I just needed to work on myself, and so I was really depressed for a long time, and I felt like putting these kind of like really intense feelings into music would not be appropriate, but then I knew it was good for my recovery. So, and working with Max and Morgan was unlike anything else I've ever experienced, so we just did it little by little, and then I went in it with the idea, like, you know, this is just a vanity project. We're never going to play live. So I wanted to write everything that I I wanted to do everything I hope to do. You know, I wanted to write a song that sounds like this or a song that sounds like this. And if this was the last album I ever made, I would be happy. So that was the intention. But before that, I just had no motivation, or I was just really afraid of playing again, because being a stagnant musician, it's like not exercising for a long time. So doing it, getting back to it, hurts a lot more.
I really like, I mean, I don't know how much of it's, you know, Max and Morgan, but the edge in the songs, I really love. It's like, it's got more, I don't know if aggression is the right word, but it has this sharper edge to it.
Yeah, I felt the same way too. And a lot, it's half and half. Like, it's like, there was one song I wanted to like write like a Ted Leo song. But then we get to Max and he just puts all in into it, and it turns into just completely different, like more harder, faster edge song. But also it comes with, like, you know, getting older and looking back at my old recordings, like I didn't sing as hard or whatever. And there was just a lot of, I spent a lot of time. It was like 4 years working on this record.
Yeah. So
I had a lot of time to refine things. And Joel, as an engineer, was really encouraging in terms of getting like the natural feelings out.
The record sounds very personal. Did you just get to a place where you felt like it was a healthy process to kind of work out what you were dealing with in song?
Yeah. Super personal, because there was a through line through all the songs. And anytime I couldn't think of a lyric, I would just think of an X-Men comic storyline and just use those. But mainly it was just about therapy. How the words would sound and what words to use were very, very important for me. And I just remember like reading like a Kathleen Hanna interview and how she was talking about how she would write music to reflect, the sound would have to reflect the lyrics. Mm-hmm. If it's sad lyrics, you know, it's kind of an obvious thing, but I would never consciously think about that. So yeah, it was very therapeutic. And there was one song, which is basically the song with Sam on vocals. It's Belasco. It's a song with two people. That's basically me writing my side of the story and then writing the other person's side of the story. And it's basically an apology. If that person ever hears that song, I doubt they will, but it's me basically saying, I finally see where you're coming from, and this is my apology.
I see. So when you say that the through line is therapy, you mean that like literally therapy, or like that the songs were intended to be therapeutic?
Yeah, both. Definitely both. Yeah, because when I lived in Georgia, I played in a couple of bands, other people's bands, but it was such a different scene for me that all I could do is like, I know playing my own songs in Athens, they're very accepting, but I always felt out of place. So I was like, I just got to do this for myself, which was what initially made Short Round Fun, was making things for myself. And then after we put out a record, I just got really depressed, because I was like, now that it's an actually a record and people know about it, all this anxiety came bubbling up, and I just couldn't write for myself anymore. So Marathon States was exactly what I intended it to be. It was no pressure, completely honest, and done on my terms kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. You did do, like, when after that first Short Run record, you did do more stuff though, right? Or did you just not feel very good about it?
We did, we did record some stuff. We put out an EP, a split EP, on my friend Tyler's label. But other than that, I really didn't feel good about anything we did after that. Well, I did two songs with Max and Morgan at the tail end of Short Round, because they were in the last iteration.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we actually played our last show with Suicide Machines in 2005. I'm sorry, what was the question again?
You said that the anxiety that came from having this first album go out into the world and basically be this thing that people could talk about and have kind of judgments about, that felt like it was crippling to you to produce music that came from an honest place. So I was asking if the stuff that you did record and write after, if you felt unhappy with it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was like, of course, you know, I expected like, oh, people are going to write reviews. That never really bothered me. If anything, I always thought the bad reviews were funny. Like, there was a Shredding Paper review. And it was one sentence. And it's like 20 something something minutes of a waste of my time. That's all it said. So,
wow.
I thought it was hilarious. I didn't really care. But it was the fact that, like, it's not private anymore that bothered me. Like, I didn't even like showing my bandmates my lyrics. Because it was really embarrassing. It doesn't make any sense when I say it, but it's how I felt. But yeah, anything I wrote after, because there was an expectation afterwards. That I have to keep on doing it. It just took. Maybe it's me being scared of challenging myself. I think that might have been part of it. But yeah, anything that I made really afterwards, I just did not like much at all.
So did Marathon States play any shows, or did it just exist in this album?
I played solo shows. I played solo shows in Georgia. I did a handful of solo shows, and that was really it. But I had to, since all the songs were written with the band, it was really hard for me to like, how do I make this a solo song? So that was really short lived. So I did write more songs after that, but they were never recorded. And I basically forgot any new song that I wrote.
What was that experience like playing the Marathon State songs? Especially, I imagine, too, like acoustic, there's more opportunity for people to actually hear what you're saying. And probably feels even more vulnerable.
Well, thankfully, a lot of time had passed by then. And that was I was in my Ted Leo phase. Whether he plays with a band or plays solo, he still has that energy.
Sure.
Because he always played with electric guitar, and that just kind of set off a light, like between him and also being an Amy Mann fan. Like, I was like, oh, you could do it. And so I did it, and everyone was really receptive. But for me, I didn't feel like I put enough time into making it its own individual, like solo version kind of thing. So I was really, really hard on myself. Yeah, I was in a much different place where I wasn't as embarrassed.
We'll be right back after this.
When did you move to Japan then? You said a couple of years ago?
Yeah, as of June, it's been 3 years.
Okay. I mean, it's a big move to leave the country. I mean,
yeah.
What led to that decision?
The election.
Was it? Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Honestly, as soon as the election dropped, because I follow that, you know, Sarah Kendzior, the journalist. Anyways, she is like a expert on like dictatorships and stuff like that and autocracies. And so I followed her a lot, and I noticed like everything that she was saying was like happening, and I'm like, I'm out. So 2016, I made my decision. And then so for the next 2 years, I, you know, slowly saved up money, and I didn't really tell anybody until like really shortly before I left. But it was that living in Georgia was really difficult. I lived there for like 11 years, and it was really, really hard. Because going from the Bay Area to this little college town in the South, it's a very, very different experience in terms of a lot of things. I became more conscious of my identity of being an Asian American. And I just got sick of a lot of things. And it was not just a fiscal decision, but like a personal decision. Moving to Japan was the only choice for me. Because I wanted to be a teacher in the U.S., but there was a lot of other problems there. So I moved here and I don't regret. There's not been a moment of pause in terms of my decision.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Are you teaching in Japan?
I'm teaching. I teach returnees, like students who have lived or studied abroad. So they speak English. But it's like funny because some speak American English, British English, or there's one woman I work with. She kind of has a Swedish accent. So it's really funny. It was great because I moved here and, you know, we don't get as many international ska punk bands over here. But I think within the first month, I got to see the Suicide Machines again.
Oh, nice.
And I went up to Jay. We've played before in Japan, but I went up to Jay. It's been years, but I went up to Jay. I'm like, well, big fan, I am. And he's like, thanks. I'm like, dude, it's me.
What was it like seeing Suicide Machines in Japan? Like, watching them play the U.S. and then was the Japanese audience different?
Well, we played with them in 2001 in Japan.
Okay,
and that was a really bit different time in terms of ska punk in Japan. It was great. It was a great tour. It was very different than when we played there in 2000, but when I saw Suicide Machines again three years ago, yeah, it was super, super, super small club, but, you know, oh no, it wasn't Suicide Machines. It was Jay and the Traitors. Jay Navarro and the Traitors.
Okay.
So it was a different vibe, but there's still, when you go to see a show in Japan, it's like front to back, everyone's down to clown. Not so much the case if you go to a show in the U.S. where some people just go to hang out. So in my experience, most Japanese punk shows are just like wall-to-wall nutty.
Okay. So people are there, they're fans of the band, they want to go all in on the experience.
Yeah. They, they're just really passionate, especially since, you know, they're an international band. How many opportunities do you get? You know, it's like when you live in a small town and then a band that you might not really be into comes in, but the general audience is still going to be really, really grateful and enthusiastic about whoever comes to their town.
Yeah. I'm curious. I'd love to get your take on, I feel like, you know, in somewhat recent years, there's been some discussion about the Chinky's legacy. Like there was an article in 2017 in Vice about Chinky's. Did you read this article?
I did. I was very surprised by it. Yeah.
So the article, the premise is like, has to do with like the fact that there was this band called The Slants came out and how they were getting all this publicity and controversy for reclaiming a slur. But then it's like, but there's this band that did it like, you know, in the 90s and nobody really thought about it. You know, it wasn't even like, it wasn't like international news. So it's kind of like, that was really the premise. Yeah, I was just curious what you thought about that and that legacy.
Oh, I'm going to get in trouble with somebody.
just go ahead. Lay it out there.
I think coming up to this, I've just been really worrying about that. Like, because, you know, you're right. The discussion has changed quite a bit these days. And, you know, honestly, I understand the premise of the name. It's just, there are a lot of people who are very passionate about that idea of like, we don't have to do these kind of things in order to challenge racism or perceptions of racism. Because honestly, I've never had a person talk to me about the name of the band and feel embarrassed about saying the name, which kind of made me uncomfortable.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it's not the same when it's like, you know, people like us in the scene who understand, you know, you don't have to tell me that you understand. I get it. But there's a lot of people, like, especially in the Asian American activist community, that would take maybe offense with it because it's like, it's not our, it would not be our job to say, hey, you should think about this more. Like, we should just be a band without that kind of name. So it should be the people who are not Asian American who should maybe do some deep thinking about, hey, this all Asian band called the, you know, see, that's the thing. It would be hard to, or you know, like Linda, the Linda Linda Lindas, or the Linda Lindas, right? They're basically all almost an all Asian band, but they don't have, you know, that kind of Asian name, although it's taken from an Asian movie. But there's no, hey, we're all Asian kind of thing. So the times have changed. So it's just, I don't know, it's just a product of its time, in my opinion. If that band was to happen today, I don't believe it would have the same name. But it's really hard because how a lot, like I said, a lot of Asian American activists think about it is very different than, like, you know, the general public. So I'm kind of split in between the two. Like, I think what we did was very important. You know, it was always great to meet Asian American fans at shows. But I'm wondering how much the name played a factor. Maybe it was kind of like that bright neon sign. And then once you come in, you understand that there's more to it. Because part of it can be construed as like that kind of Asian American comedian that just gets popular by making self-deprecating Asian jokes, which we didn't really do.
I thought it was weird in the article that the author pointed to the song Asian Prodigy as like an example of how you were addressing, Mike was addressing these issues of being Asian. And I felt like that's like the only song, I think. And it's just a song he wrote really about what it was like to grow up in his own family.
Sure. Yeah. And see, that's a problem that's happening right now, is that a lot of people are tired of the same story. Like, people didn't like my stinky lunch, or people, or I had strict parents. So a lot of people nowadays are very tired with that, theme. But the thing is, at that time, this was what, you know, 98.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't really compare the two, I don't believe.
It's I don't know what your perspective is, but from my point of view, it seemed like it was in the 90s, you know, there was very, very little representation of Asian Americans in like music or TV or whatever. But now there's a lot more, but there's also a lot more overt racism towards Asian Americans.
Absolutely.
So on one hand, it seems like, wow, there's more representation and there's more showing of the different sides of Asian American people. But there's also like more like hate and like this. And it's really like really, really upsetting. So I don't know what that is, you know, how we view this as a culture, these two things.
Well, you have to respect everyone's opinions. No, I think I just think it goes back to that whole, that quote where it's like, to some, equality feels like oppression. You know, where, you know, growing up in the Bay Area, even though there was a huge Asian population, I remember hearing a lot of racist garbage growing up, mm-hmm. because there were so many Asians. Just like in the South, there was more anti-Black sentiment that I heard because there's such a big Black population. And the thing is, for these people getting louder and louder with their racism, that's just like, I don't want to say growing pains, but it's that kind of subconsciously, I'm losing foothold on dominating this media or whatever. That's how I feel. So, yeah, it's definitely no one could argue that more and more Asian representation is good, but I think what's important, back to what we're talking about with the article, is like the variety of representation is just as important, because, you know, you grow up in the Bay Area, how many Asian friends do you have? And they're all different. And in the punk, and how many do you see at the punk scene? And it's just kind of like a given that you're, that, oh, there's a lot of different types of people we see at a punk show. And I think in general, that's what the general public needs to see more of. Because, like, I remember some Asian American online magazine, they put out a Asian artists list, and it was all dance music.
Yeah.
Which is weird. It's like, because for me, like, all the Asians I know, they either listen to hip hop, Depeche Mode, or punk rock.
Interesting. Yeah.
What do you think?
What do I think? Adam, what do you think?
What do you think, Adam?
The whole thing brought me back to, do you remember when we were at a party at Dottie's house in Gilroy?
Yes, 100%.
And some fucking drunk dude called you Mushu Pork.
I don't remember that name, but yeah, I remember him being racist. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was drunk, and so we all got on his case. And then I remember he tried to spout some shit. He was like, hey, man, it's the year 2000. Racism's dead.
Well, he was trying to start a rap.
And first off, it was the year 2001.
Yeah, he was probably trying to rap. But yeah, I remember. Like, you and I, we've talked about that other times. The year 2000. It's the year 2000. Racism is dead. But it's the year 2001.
Racism is back.
The, okay. Yeah, yeah. Racism is back. Yeah. I don't know. It's because, you know, the thing is, Adam, you and I, we make jokes a lot, right?
Yeah.
And because you're my buddy. And but then when I moved to Georgia, and it was like I went through a time machine. The amount of racism I got, it was just debilitating. So whenever, like, you know, you and I would text, I'd be like, ah, man, not now. Just like, I'm too tired.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, it wasn't like I'm mad at everybody. It was just like, dude, that stuff can really take it out of you. Cause I was, you know, that, you know, I grew up seeing everyone. You know, I grew up in a town, it was like 40% Asian. And then I moved to Georgia, it was like 4%.
Yeah. All bad.
Yeah, all bad, but then, yeah. But then, ska. Yeah.
And ska.
But then ska.
I lived in Las Vegas. My wife and I moved there for like a year. This was like 99, 2000. And now I'm not saying like California doesn't have like racism problems, especially institutional racism. But
of course,
my experience growing up in California was people weren't, they didn't broadcast it, at least, you know?
Yeah.
But living in Las Vegas for a year, like where I was a waiter for at Denny's, I delivered pizza. I had a few experiences where people I barely knew just would see me as a white person, and they would just say horrible racist things to me, like nothing, like they just assumed I was on board. And it actually shocked me so much. I was like, didn't even know how to respond. Like, I wasn't prepared to be like, don't say that to me. Like,
right.
Fuck off. I wasn't even prepared for that because I wasn't even used to that. So it was just weird to like, you know, go to this other place. That's kind of, I don't know. I mean, it's not exactly what you're saying, but it was weird. I wasn't used to that, like that kind of behavior, really.
It's weird. You know, it's like, you know, being a cisgendered man, I didn't, for a long time, I was not aware of my privilege. You know, I thought I was a good feminist ally because I listened to feminist punk bands, but that was not the case. And then, you know, if a woman was around me and I wouldn't do anything, but like if she was getting defensive or whatever, I'm like, what just happened? And I would have to think about what they were going through. I'm like, you know what, if I'm a sexist guy, I should probably think about that. I should probably reconsider what I've been doing. But yeah, it is does take you aback when you're in a new environment and these people are acting a certain way, you know?
And they make assumptions about you based off of, you know, your shared privilege, and you're not used to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I've gotten to the point in my years where I'm like, you know, I'm not going to tell them, I'm not going to try to change someone else's behavior. As long as, like, the people around me are positive, that's all I can do. Because,
yeah,
I'm in a position right now where I live, you know, a lot of people who have moved here from, like, the U.S. or whatever, they have different. I run into a lot of really bad people who move here and they don't think I speak English, so I'll hear a lot of racist stuff.
Wow.
And I'm not going to argue with them. I'm just not, for most of the time. I'm just going to say, fuck it. I have my own things to deal with. I will tell, however, the bartender what they're saying. And then the bartender will charge them double.
Sure, yeah. Good.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the show wherever you normally download podcasts. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's at In Defense of Ska. You can also sign up for my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get the podcast sent directly to your inbox every Wednesday. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has a great band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram. It's simply at Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And on that note, we leave you by saying ska now more than ever. Thank you.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.